Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 6th of January. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about the escalating military action in Gaza. There have been international calls for an immediate ceasefire. What's the goal of Israel in this military action? What is causing Hamas to send rockets into Israel? And once again, we ask, what is the way out? We'll have two guests with us during the course of the hour. Charles Levinson is Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and he is currently on the Gaza border. His reports this week and yesterday have been from there, and he's been talking about the Israeli planes and ships that have been pounding targets in the Gaza Strip as tanks and troops appear to hold on to positions that they took in a weekend ground assault. There is news today that a rocket fired by Palestinian militants at southern Israel have happened, and that the Israeli forces have edged closer to Gaza's major population centers and attacked new targets, including a UN school, taking more civilian lives. We'll also be speaking later this hour with Juan Cole. Juan Cole is the Richard Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan and author of the forthcoming book, Engaging the Muslim World. Yesterday during our open line, we had many, many phone calls with people wanting to talk about this situation in the Middle East, and we will give you that chance to do so today. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. And I believe our first guest, Charles Levinson, is with us now, joining us from the Gaza border. Charles Levinson, hello.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Hi, I'm okay. How are you?
Good, thanks.
What news are you reporting today?
Well, actually, today, we're looking at the increased shelling in Gaza, the ongoing ground offensive. They hit the school, as you mentioned in your introduction. It seems like, I don't want to say necessarily dangerous escalation, but the sort of, humanitarian misstep that has derailed a lot of Israeli offensives in the past. In 96 in Lebanon and Kana, when they shelled the UN camp and it forced them to stop the offensive against Hezbollah. Again, in 2002 in Jenin, it was, going in hard, and they really inflated reports of civilian casualties that, caused that operation to flounder a bit. In Lebanon in 2006, they again hit the house in Kana that killed 28 people, 14 kids, all civilians, and they were forced to, announce a 48-hour ceasefire because of the outcry in response to that. And then also, in 2006 in Gaza, you had the Hoda Ghalia, the girl on the beach, whose family was hit by an errant Israeli shell, wiped out her whole family. 7-year-old Hoda was caught on film crying. And again, the outcry really forced Israel to step back in its operation. So these are the sort of things, these are the sort of events, what happened to the UN school today, that could really cause a, increase the amount of international outcry and cause a sort of a change in, may force Israel right to step back at some point.
It would seem as though Israel has a fairly sophisticated military. What would be the reason for humanitarian, and they obviously have huge ramifications, humanitarian mistakes?
Well, it's a pretty brutal war. I mean, they're using a lot of artillery. Artillery is not all that precise when it comes down to it. It's a one of the deadliest weapons in the history of warfare. Mm-hmm. If you lob enough artillery shells into crowded urban areas, you're not going to hit only militants. And, even with laser-guided airstrikes, again, these are crowded urban environments. And there's going to be, collateral damage, as the military calls it.
Right. Tell me about the calls, the international calls for an immediate ceasefire. Where are they coming from, and are they falling on deaf ears, or is anybody listening?
Well, they're coming from a lot of the European countries. Sarkozy, of course, was, calling for it today in Damascus and was here in Jerusalem yesterday. The British Prime Minister has also thrown in his voice. But, all that aside, without, the one voice that really matters to Israel, the U.S. hasn't called for ceasefire yet. It continues to back the operation pretty much fully. And until the U.S., changes its stance, Israel probably won't, pay much heed to the international calls for a ceasefire.
I think the NPR News report at the top of the hour was saying that the real influence is the United States. So you're saying that there needs to be a call. If there were a call from, I don't know which administration would make the call, or if both of them would make the call, that Israel would adhere to a ceasefire?
And that's part of the problem. I mean, yes, I think that. I mean, that's where that's this is the one voice that really has, that Israel has to listen to and has to, you know, pay heed to. But that's what, you know, you just mentioned the problem is, you know, this is in between administrations. Bush is on his way out. Obama's not yet in and has stayed, you know, really noticeably silent on this issue since it began. And, you know, some have even speculated that's part of the reason Israel chose this timing, thinking that, you know, in the transition period between the two administrations, you know, they would, you know, the U.S. would be less likely to, you know, really take a definitive stance one way or the other, mm-hmm. or to call for pressure for a ceasefire.
Charles, what do you think the goal was of Hamas to send rockets into Israel? And what's the goal of Israel with this military incursion? What are they each saying?
Well, I mean, the rocket fire is nothing new. It's been going on for years. And, you know, at varying levels, it's got, you know, sometimes it's a few a day, a few a week. Other times it's, you know, it's at the most intense, it's been 70 to 80 a day, I think. And it's always, you know, the Palestinian militants have always, there's been sort of an equation. You know, they fire a few rockets, Israel maybe responds with a few airstrikes, a brief incursion. You know, there's sort of been a balanced give and take. And I think, you know, Palestinian, you know, Hamas and other Palestinian groups thought that more or less that was sort of that equation would go on. Israel got fed up with it this time. The ceasefire ended. Hamas, you know, started firing rockets again. There was a lot of talk that Hamas was divided, that the more moderate political leadership in Gaza didn't want to end the ceasefire, didn't want to resume the rocket fire, but that, you know, the more hardliners, the militant wing in Gaza, the exiled leadership in Damascus was really pushing to end the ceasefire. Their main stated objective in ending the ceasefire and resuming the rockets was to, you know, open up the crossings more, to end the siege on Gaza, to get more free flow of goods in and out so that, you know, Gaza's economy can begin to prosper somewhat. Israel doesn't want that to happen because their whole game plan right now is to bolster the West Bank, make the West Bank prosper, at least comparatively speaking to Gaza, so that Mahmoud Abbas and the more moderate Palestinians who are willing to negotiate with Israel and this and that, you know, look good to Palestinians, mm-hmm. whereas Gaza suffers. So Israel does not want to open up these crossings.
Mm-hmm.
But the rocket fire, you know, we're a month before elections. The rocket fire resumed. This is, you know, created a lot of political pressure on Israel's leadership. And, you know, they decided enough is enough and, you know, launched this really, you know, fierce offensive.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday in your article, you said that the government officials in Israel have said their aim is simply to reduce rocket fire and weaken Hamas. Do you suspect that really their goal is to get rid of Hamas, to just pound it into non-existence?
Right. I mean, there's certainly a lot of debate about that. A lot of people think that that is the direction Israel is going in. And, you know, there's also a point of no return, even if that's not Israel's objective. You know, if you crush enough government, you know, institutions and infrastructure, and you do enough damage to Hamas, then, you know, who's left to administer the territory afterwards? There are certainly voices inside the Israeli military and inside the Israeli political establishment that would like to see Hamas toppled, you know, right. crushed in Gaza. I think the more, at least those speaking publicly for Israel, are saying that's not the goal, that's not the objective, that's not what they want to do. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
There's also been, you know, we reported yesterday that there are some Israeli diplomats in Washington and some State Department officials have started to discuss this idea seriously of ending, sort of, you know, letting this operation lead to the end of Hamas and reinstating the Fatah-controlled Palestinian Authority in Gaza. How serious that is, how likely that is to happen, it's hard to say. Certainly Fatah would have to be a little bit hesitant about that scenario, because if they're seen among Palestinians, among the Arab world, as coming back to power in Gaza on the heels of the Israeli invasion, because Israel went in on with this, you know, devastating offensive that killed however many hundreds of Palestinians, they're going to look like collaborators. They're going to look like, you know, they'll lose a lot of legitimacy in the eyes of their people, their constituency in Palestine and in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm. And what are the other ideas that are being discussed concerning the rocket attacks? What would be a better way to stop the rocket attacks?
I mean, that's the thing. There is no way to stop the rocket attacks.
Mm.
It's either political. The only two ways to really stop the rocket attacks are political settlement with the people doing it, you know, a political agreement with Hamas, which, you know, Israel's not really ready to negotiate with this organization, and this organization, Hamas, is not really ready to negotiate with Israel. So either Hamas agrees to stop it and to stop the people of the other groups who are firing them, or Israel literally takes control of the Gaza Strip, reoccupies the entire Strip, keeps its army there, takes physical possession of the territory used to fire rockets. And that is, that means a big, big military operation and a long-term extended presence in Gaza, which, Israel says it doesn't want, and I don't think Israelis would stomach, but who knows? Nobody thought Israel would go back into the West Bank in 2002 and retake Jenin and Hebron and Nablus and all these huge cities bigger than Gaza, more populous than Gaza. They thought it was unheard of, unthinkable that Israel could do this, and they did it. So, who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, so many people say two-state solution. They've been saying it for years. It took quite a while to get some to agree to that. You got to wonder, why doesn't somebody move that along really fast?
Yeah. No, the two-state solution has not we've moved, so certainly since the past 10 years, we've moved away from a two-state solution more than we've moved towards a two-state solution, I think, in terms of, just what's going on the ground here.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls, and here's our number, 800-486-8655. First of two guests today, Charles Levinson. Charles Levinson is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he's on the Gaza border right now and has been reporting about what's been going on in the Gaza Strip. A little bit later on, Juan Cole will join us. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan, author of the forthcoming book, Engaging the Muslim World. Join us now with your comments. Our number again, 800-486-8655. And our lines are open for you at this moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Levinson, Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, is joining us from the Gaza border the first half hour of today's program. Our number again is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Charles, these reports seem to change every day, but even yesterday people were saying, well, this is only going to last about a week. It will be very short. Israel will have proved its point. Do you suspect that this will be a short war or not?
It's hard to say. I mean, I don't think the war has huge popularity right now in Israel. With time, that, and especially if casualties continue to go up, as they've already started to, you had, three Israelis killed last night, and I think another one killed today. As casualties mount, the populist support for the war will go down. As the war drags on, support for the war will go down. As the rocket fire continues, which it so far has, support for the war will also go on as the military is seen to be not, achieving its objectives. That being said, what I expect, if I were to predict, I think, you'll see sort of another some days, week, let's say, a very, fairly limited period of sort of intense fighting, real intense fighting phase, and then Israel will sort of consolidate the land it's taken, hold on to it. There'll still be sporadic fights, occasional airstrikes, sporadic gun battles, things like that, but it'll die down, and then you'll sort of see the negotiation period. How those negotiations take place will be obviously through a mediator of some sort, whether it's Egypt or Turkey or who knows, France. But there'll be some sort of indirect negotiation going on that will presumably involve, an Israeli withdrawal from the land it's taken in the Gaza Strip in exchange for, a credible commitment by Hamas, a commitment that Israel is satisfied with. By Hamas to stop the rocket fire. That's sort of my prediction, but mm-hmm. it's just that. It's a prediction. It's a guess. This is the Middle East. Anything can happen. It's,
right.
Making predictions here is not a rewarding business.
Let's go to phone calls for Charles. We start with Fred from Stevens Point. Hi, Fred.
Hey, good morning.
Hello.
Hey, you suggested, or somebody has suggested, that two-state solution to the conflict, and I really don't see where that would become a solution, as the Palestinians and the Arab world in general has stated over and over that no Israel, no way, and they will not stop until Israel is buried and non-existent. So how can you even think about a two-state solution there? Personally, I would love to see them be like as the United States, where a democracy, everybody has a vote and lives together in relative peace and harmony. That's a pipe dream, but we're not totally harmonic here in the United States, but it's, in my opinion, better than anything else I've seen in the world. I'll hang up and let you guys respond.
Thanks, Fred. Charles?
Certainly there are those in the Arab world and among Palestinians who feel that Israel should, shouldn't exist and should be, wiped out at all costs, but there are also you know, a significant population, you know, a significant part of this region and Palestinians, including their leadership in the West Bank, who has accepted a two-state solution and has, you know, publicly and, you know, supported a two-state solution and negotiated toward that end for, you know, the past, you know, since the 90s. So, and you know, as these things have a way of building mass. So the people, you know, I think a lot of people who maybe are on the fence, you know, if they see things getting better and they see things improving, if they see their lives improving, if they see the checkpoints in the West Bank being removed, if they see less Israeli incursions in Gaza, less, you know, less people dying, life getting better, you know, you'll see more support for a two-state solution, more acceptance of Israel. But no, it's not going to happen overnight, and it's something that's going to take time, for sure.
And we go to Boots, is it, from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, how are you?
I'm doing well. In 2002, June, I went to Gaza to do some just personal research just because I'd have many arguments with my family. I am Jewish, and so whenever I would speak out against Israel, I would be barraged with being an anti-Semite or self-hating Jew. So they said, you got to go there and see for yourself. So I went there, but I went where they wouldn't go, and I went into Gaza and into Bethlehem. And unfortunately, what I found was that I was kind of right. And I'm wondering, nobody speaks much of how Israel has been in control of the electricity and the water filtration, the sanitation systems, and they'll turn these on and off intermittently. They say it's for their protection, so the terrorists can't plan anything. But it's been ongoing for decades that the electricity is turned on and off, the water is turned on and off, commerce is... I was stuck in Rafah because they wouldn't let me through with my American passport. They wouldn't let me through their checkpoint. They said the checkpoints close at sundown, and the sun was still up. You know, yes, Hamas is a organization that embraces theological and political extremism, no doubt, and they're throwing rockets into Israel, no doubt. But Israel has been controlling their utilities and just messing with their heads.
Charles,
I mean, yeah. So I mean, certainly with regard to the crossings into and out of Gaza, I mean, that's one of the chief complaints of every Palestinian. I mean, it turns the territory into a prison. People can't come and go. Commerce can't come and go. Goods can't come and go. You know, a farmer grows a crop of tomatoes and doesn't know if he's going to be able to get it out to sell it when it picks. That's, you know, that's one of the chief reasons, if not the chief reason, you know, the ceasefire ended and this thing started again. Well, you know, it's from the Hamas's and the Palestinians' perspective. And in the West Bank also, you know, that freedom of movement issue, the checkpoints, the roadblocks, you know, it can take you four, you know, however many hours to drive what should take 15 minutes because, you know, there's so many roadblocks and they're unpredictable. You don't know if you'll get through in 10 minutes or in 2 hours. And that's, you know, absolutely a huge problem. With regards to the utilities, you know, Israel would say, you know, we give them electricity and water. I mean, look, we care about these people. We provide them electricity and water. I know in, you know, in this conflict, they have shut off electricity. I haven't, you know, and I could be wrong here, but in my experience, it's not something they've used as a weapon all that much. I mean, they haven't, I don't feel like they've cut it off. They cut off water and electricity all that much in the past, like as regularly as the caller implied. But there could be plenty. There could be incidents of it happening that I'm not aware of. But no, absolutely. I mean, the Israelis. You know, Israel says we pulled soldiers and settlers out of Gaza, and they're still, you know, they're still firing rockets. They're still unhappy. And the Palestinians say, yeah, we're still unhappy because yeah, you pulled out, but you still got us locked in. You've got us sieged in here. You know, we can't get in. We can't get out. We can't trade. And that is a, you know, a huge problem and a huge complaint. And certainly, any long-term settlement between these two parties will have to, you know, have to address that.
Boots, thanks for the call. Frank from Sheboygan. Hi.
Hello. I'm calling with an idea that occurred to me as I listened to your program. It seems to me that there's a parallel here with the Israelis limiting access in and out of Gaza and, as I just heard, now controlling utilities. It seems to me that there's a parallel with what the Soviets did to the city of Berlin. And the U.S. responded to the Berlin blockade by airlifting in food, medicine, fuel, and... I was wondering if the Arab states, who should be sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians in Gaza, were to provide similar aid and bring in the food, medicine supplies, provide fresh water, an offshore desalinization ship or whatever, so so that the lives of the Palestinians were better, and they'd say to the Israelis, keep up your blockade for as long as you want. It doesn't make any difference. Our people are living well and are happy. That doesn't address unemployment issues, but at least the quality of life would improve.
Charles.
Well, you know, the Berlin airlift won't work in Gaza because Israel controls the airspace. There's no airport, and, they wouldn't allow a bunch of planes coming from Saudi Arabia to land in Gaza, even if there was a functioning airport, or from whatever country. They control sea space also, so bringing in boats is, Israel wouldn't allow it, although, the past few months they have allowed, I think, half a dozen boats to come from Cyprus. They put a stop to that more recently. But that's a very new phenomenon, very unpredictable and erratic. And, if boats started coming from, I'm sure Israel's keeping a very close eye on it, and we'll shut it off again at any point, just as they have for this conflict. The one big issue here is, the southern border with Egypt. That's the one border with Gaza that Israel doesn't control. And Egypt has come under huge attack from in the world of public opinion in the Arab world and among Palestinians for keeping that border closed, for not letting in supplies, not letting Palestinians out. It's a major issue, and they're widely criticized for it. From the Egyptian regime's perspective, I think they feel that if they were to open that border and make it a normal border between two states, that would be a way of legitimizing Hamas, which Egypt isn't really wild about. Egypt has their own Muslim Brotherhood, their own Islamist groups to contend with. It is an opponent of the regime. Hamas is, an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. And they don't want to empower an organization that could, lead to the empowerment of the Muslim group, of Islamist groups in their own country. Not to mention that, Egypt is closely allied with the United States, with sort of what's referred to as the moderate wing of the Arab world. And, Hamas has allied itself with, the other wing, Iran, Syria, the Hezbollah wing.
Right.
And I think that's why Egypt continues to keep that border sealed.
Yeah. Just a couple of final questions. What are the restrictions that you as a reporter face?
Now, that's been a really interesting issue in this conflict. For the first time in my experience covering this conflict, which goes back to 2006, Israel has totally sealed off the Gaza Strip to media.
Hmm.
And there's an uproar about it. There's been, the Foreign Press Association here has filed lawsuits, has got a Supreme Court ruling saying they have to let the media in, and still they're not letting the media in. And people, as a result, the journalists are stuck covering this conflict, from these hilltops outside the Gaza Strip, which is, pretty useless. It's maddening. It's in violation of a Supreme Court order. Strategically, it's probably, strategically from Israel's perspective, it's, pretty clever, maybe one could say. It's forcing the press corps, the international press corps, to cover this conflict on the Israeli side of the border. So that means they're standing on these hilltops which are next to Stay Road. So they're exposed to the Qassam rocket fire every day. The Israeli spokespeople have full access to every journalist that's down here, because they're forced to stay in Israel proper, not going to Gaza. If they were in Gaza, there'd be a lot more coverage, a lot more graphic images, a lot more, visual reporting of, what's going on there, the suffering, the death, destruction, the damage, and that's not happening. Instead, everything we know about what's going on in Gaza is coming from, local Palestinian journalists down there who work with all these organizations, and, this is sadly, that's just not going to have the same weight, the same credibility as, whatever, a big-time and,
right.
Big-time television correspondent down there, walking through the rubble of a bombed house where, a three-year-old has died, which those sort of images really resonate and echo
in
international public opinion, and that's not happening.
Right. And finally, when you talked about possible mediators, it was interesting what you said about Egypt, that it might be Egypt, it might be Turkey, it might be France. Is there one of those countries that might be more successful than another in helping to mediate?
Well, Egypt has been historically it's been Egypt, has played that role. But Egypt's relations with Hamas are badly strained. First off, Hamas backed out of sort of ceasefire or talks in Cairo planned earlier this year before the ceasefire expired. The very last minute, Hamas backed out. It was seen as an embarrassment to Egypt. Egypt got really mad at Hamas. now, after this, the conflict has started and Egypt has taken this firestorm of, you know, blame for sort of siding with Israel, basically, you know, keeping the border closed, things have gotten worse. And don't forget, Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni went to Cairo about 2 days before the air bombardment started. That was, you know, has fed all sorts of, you know, theories that she went there and got sort of the blessing from Egypt to go get those Hamas guys. Who knows if that's true? That's the way it's perceived here. And that's definitely hurt Egypt's, you know, credibility as a potential mediator in this conflict. The interesting party that's emerged in the past, you know, in this conflict and a little bit before it, and would be a new force of mediation, is Turkey. Turkey has sort of become, you know, because Turkey helped bridge, you know, helped mediate recent Israeli-Syrian peace talks, Turkey has also sort of been, names been mentioned frequently in terms of this conflict, getting involved to help mediate some sort of agreement between Israel and Hamas. Mm. So that would be the interesting one to watch, I think.
Good. Thank you, Charles, so much for being with us this morning. Thank you.
It was my pleasure, Kathleen.
Charles Levinson is Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and he is on the Gaza border right now reporting on the military incursion by the Israelis into Gaza and the rocket attacks from Gaza into Israel, and does fine reporting. We thank him for being with us. We'll continue with your phone calls, so stay on hold, please, if that's where you are and you want to comment. Your comments will be applicable to the next half-hour conversation as well, of course. Our phone number remaining, and we have a couple lines open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And joining us in just a moment, Professor Juan Cole. It's been a little while since we've spoken with Professor Cole. He is the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan, the author of a number of books, including one that is forthcoming, and we'll talk to him as soon as this is released, Engaging the Muslim World, which will be published in March of 2009, which is this brand new year. So we continue our conversation and welcome more of your phone calls. We're looking at this military, well, this war again in the Middle East and trying to figure out how it can be ceased and who might be able to negotiate and why there have been, and I think we'll ask Professor Cole that right off the bat, so many humanitarian mistakes so far and why it is restrictions have been placed on the press not being allowed in Gaza to see exactly what is happening. We're talking about all of that this hour of the program. And Professor Cole is joining us right now. Professor Juan Cole, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Kathleen.
Not that we're seeing a lot of this because of the restrictions on the press, but tell me, Professor Cole, why you think the Israelis are again making what our last guest called so many humanitarian mistakes in this war.
Well, I'm afraid I don't think they're making humanitarian mistakes in the war. I think they are disregarding humanitarian considerations in the war. They are deliberately going after the targets they want to go after, regardless of what happens to civilians.
Why would they do that when that obviously would not play very well in the rest of the world or some parts of the rest of the world?
Well, I'm afraid they still have a kind of us versus them mentality. They don't feel that the rest of the world likes them very much, and they don't care what the rest of the world thinks, and they feel their existence is fragile, and that this is what they need to do, and they're going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think their existence is fragile?
No. I think they vastly overestimate the threats to themselves. They overestimate the strength of the enemy. It's understandable, of course, given their history, that they should feel so threatened. It's a little bit odd to think that Hamas, in this vast enclosed slum of 1.5 million people, represents an existential threat to Israel, which is a modern state of over 7 million with a per capita income more than that of Spain or Austria.
Charles was talking to us from the Wall Street Journal, who's on the Gaza border, the first half hour of our show, and he was commenting, and I guess the press is really very upset about this, that Israel will not let reporters into Gaza to cover this war. Why so many restrictions? And why do you think Israel would do that?
Well, you know, they have made a decision that they are going to go after Hamas, that they are going to disregard the inevitable civilian casualties that will be caused by going after Hamas in this way. And they understand that it will be distasteful to the outside world to see the images of children with their abdomens cut open and children missing limbs and women dead and non-combatants. And they are, it's part of their warfare. It is a propaganda move to prevent the outside world from seeing those things.
We were talking about the only real influence on Israel is the United States, and the United States is not using that influence. Would you agree that that's the case, and does the United States need to say something, to do something now?
Well, of course, it's the Bush administration we're talking about. They're the ones that have been ceded foreign policy, and they agree with the Israeli point of view that Hamas is dangerous, that it should be wiped out, and that it should be wiped out at all costs to the Gazan civilian population.
Let's go back to phone calls. Professor Juan Cole is our guest now, and we go to Royce from Madison. Hi, Royce.
Good morning. My question is, why is the U.S. financing this slaughter? The reason that it can go on is that, you know, we're providing military and financial support, and on top of it, we're blocking ceasefire efforts, and it makes me really upset that the media isn't reporting more accurately our role in this whole effort.
Professor Cole.
Yes, well, it's something that the world is very well aware of. All of these attacks are being conducted with American weapons, mostly paid for by the American public. It is technically illegal for them to be deployed in this manner. That is to say, they are supposed to be used only for defense. This operation clearly goes way beyond defense at this point. But Israel won't be called on that. The reasons for which there's this kind of almost 100% consensus in the U.S. Congress to sort of support Israel 100% no matter what, the reasons for that are very complex. I mean, one is that from the very beginning, the whole project of planting a Jewish homeland in Palestine was an imperial project. It was done by the British Empire in order to have allies in a relatively hostile region that was strategically important. And I think a lot of that kind of thinking continued when the United States took over from Great Britain as a world power. Beyond that, of course, there is a very wealthy and powerful set of lobbies in the United States. Some of them Christian Zionist, others, from the Jewish community, that have been important in funding congressional campaigns and which use a deliberate technique of targeting critics of Israel in Congress for unelection, and they've been successful in this, or at least perceived to be successful in this. So it's a complex mixture of things, but it does produce a U.S. government that is really indistinguishable in most of its stances on these matters from the Israeli government.
Let me ask you, Professor Cole, how is Israel to keep Hamas from firing rockets into Israel?
It can't be done.
It can't be done.
No, it's impossible. Militarily. In these rockets, they're called rockets, but a lot of them are just homemade little things that anyone could make with a chemistry set. And as long as there are people in Gaza that are disgruntled, it's always possible for them to get one off. And some of them are not being done by Hamas at all. They're being done by small splinter groups with odd names, you know, various forms of Islamic Jihad and so forth. So that even Hamas couldn't impose discipline on this matter. the only way to get a resolution of this thing is not a military and assassinations and bombings and so forth, but a negotiated settlement. And, you know, you have to look at the situation on the ground in Gaza. Gaza has no port because it's been destroyed or not allowed to be built. It has no airport. It had one, but the Israelis bombed it. They view Gaza as a security matter, and therefore they've put it in prison. It has no economic outlets in the last year and a half. It's had no economic input. The people are half-starved. They're being denied needed services. You can't brutalize a population like that. And this has been going on in one way or another since 1967 without producing a crisis.
Let's go. Thanks very much for the call, Royce. Let's go to Khalil from Waukegan. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, taking us back to the end of World War II, when the Jews fled Germany, they were denied access to Britain, France, and Spain. And then they were basically put into Palestine. My question, because the beginning of this conflict starts there. Nobody reports on this. Nobody speaks about that. And for all intents and purposes, if there was supposed to be a resolution, if there was ever going to be a resolution, then the Jews who are in there, who claim to be the children of Israel, need to solidify that claim, because that claim has never been solidified. There's never been any proof given as to that claim. It's always been referred to the Bible, but where's the history?
Professor Cole?
Well, sure. I mean, the project of planting a Jewish homeland in Palestine was announced by Britain during the World War I in the Balfour Declaration. It was, at the time, you know, a kind of minor matter, because very few Jews living in Berlin and Paris and so forth would have wanted to live in dusty towns like Jaffa in Palestine. But it was the rise of the Axis in the 1930s that impelled hundreds of thousands of Jews to flee Europe. And ultimately, they went for a state, and they got one. I think, you know, Israel's existence and justification have been resolved. It's a member of the United Nations. It has all of the prerequisites of a United Nations member. The other United Nations members are supposed to respect its existence, its sovereignty. Even the Arab League offered a wide-ranging peace treaty and recognition in 2002, which has never been taken off the table. It was rejected by the Israelis. Some of its provisions are unrealistic, but, you know, a negotiation process is there for the recognition of Israel. So I don't think, you know, these matters are always posed in the most melodramatic terms. This is not a matter of the existence of Israel, the recognition of Israel. This is a matter of a security issue between Israel and its Palestinian colonies. And that security issue can't be resolved as long as it has Palestinian colonies, and the Israeli leadership is unwilling to make the kinds of hard decisions on colonization that would resolve this issue.
Thanks very much for the call, Khalil. We'll take more in a moment. Our guest this half hour is Professor Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, author of the forthcoming book, Engaging the Muslim World, which will be published in March. And you can be assured that we will talk with him about this book as soon as that one's published. Our number, 800-486-8655, and we have one line open for you. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Juan Cole is our guest, and we go back to your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Daniel is next from Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. I was horrified to hear that the numbers of noncombatants killed by the Israeli only include women and children. Men are counted as terrorist Hamas members. How can the Israeli only count women and children as so-called collateral damage? What percentage of the 400-plus killed by the Israeli really are the terrorists?
Well, that's correct. It's to my knowledge, it's not the Israelis who are counting in that way, but the UN and relief organizations. It's a way of making a very solid count in the sense that if you have a 7-year-old child dead or a woman dead, then you're very unlikely to be dealing with a guerrilla. The fact is that it's being alleged by a Norwegian physician who's there on the ground, Mads Gilbert, that of the 2,500 or so wounded, half, 50% are civilians. And of the over 500 dead, we don't know exactly how many are civilians, but certainly it's more than the figure typically given in the press, which is based upon this way of counting. In fact, a lot of those men who have been killed are simply Gaza policemen. And since Hamas won the 2006 elections in the Palestine Authority, it became the political force that appointed policemen and controlled policemen. But these are, you know, had a different party won, then they would be serving that party. So to kill the policeman is actually questionable as well.
What do you think the goal is? What is Israel's goal in this military event?
Well, they're trying to destroy Hamas as an organization. Hamas is a fundamentalist Muslim group that rejects the legitimacy of the State of Israel and which is willing to engage in violence, terrorism, rocketry, mm-hmm. and so forth to challenge Israel. It is militant. It is an organization that the Israelis simply cannot bide having on their border. But, I mean, the issue with this sort of thing is that the Israelis believe that a very carefully planned counterinsurgency operation, which in a densely populated area, can succeed in rooting out Hamas as an organization, can destroy the organization. And the rest of the world, including, you know, Jane's Defense Weekly and other non-wimpy sorts of analysts, can't see why the Israelis think they can do it that way. It's very unlikely, and of course, it's going to be a long time before the Gaza population is going to forgive them for what they've done.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to David from, San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, morning, Kathleen and Professor. Hey, you know, that last caller just was asking about casualties, and I was watching C-SPAN a day or so ago, and they had the United Nations was dealing with those body counts, and I'm trying to think of the there's a United States representative. He's not a U.S. rep, but he's with the United Nations, and he went into a long argument, harangue about the females and children. I think he was saying there were 62 dead, and that was the guaranteed civilian population that was dead. And I'm just wondering, I think if you went to C-SPAN, you could probably find that little episode and figure out just how they came up with that rationalization. By the way, there's also Mosaic. Probably the professor knows about Mosaic. It's a news broadcast that comes out of Link TV, and I think if you go to Link TV and then look for Mosaic, you can see all of these broadcasts coming out of the Middle East, and you can get that perspective, because the casualty figure of 500 or so was, God, that's got to be 4 or 5 days old, and the totality, just looking at Mosaic last night, they're just shooting these random rockets into skyscrapers or at least tall buildings. You can't, this is one of the most populated areas in the world, and you can't just be lobbing missiles into an area without killing dozens, if not hundreds, at a time. And the way these helicopters are flying out, and you see these missiles coming out in just random directions, these are not smart weapons, so it's pretty amazing. But, I wanted to ask you, my brain is just seized up. It wasn't about casualties. Can you tell me what I told this screener?
Something about fast-tracking weapon.
Oh, yeah, that was
right.
It. I'm just wondering if Bush isn't having a fire sale. You know, in other words, Israel typically gets their weapons from the United States, and Bush has got about 2 weeks to go, and if Israel burns through a massive quantity of weapons, can they get them replaced virtually instantly by the outgoing Bush administration?
Well, it's not necessary to have a war on Gaza to get weapons to Israel. In fact, Bush announced a $20 billion deal to sell weapons to the oil states of the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, and so forth. Of course, this raised anxieties in the Israel lobbies, and so he turned around and offered Israel $30 billion. In weaponry, I think much of it not purchased, simply a grant. And so Bush has been seeding the Middle East with enormous amounts of future American sophisticated weaponry, which in and of itself probably will cause wars because, you know, if you've got nice new shiny weaponry, it's no good to you unless you use it. And if you don't use it fairly soon after you get it, it becomes antiquated. So the military-industrial complex in the United States has done very well out of Bush, and they're going to continue to do well, and it's going to cause the Middle East to be bristling with American weapons.
And what about the Obama administration? Have they made statements that have made you listen about this situation? Do you expect something quite different from them?
No. The situation is structural, so it doesn't matter very much which administration is in. It can matter at the margins. Clinton negotiated quite a lot with the Israelis and the Palestinians, although he mainly represented the Israeli point of view to the Palestinians, and did try to get some sort of diplomatic settlement. But his support for Israel never wavered. In fact, he may have been the most pro-Israeli president we ever had. And I don't anticipate that Obama's stance will be any different. The considerations that lead U.S. foreign policy in this direction are not going to change, and therefore the policy is very unlikely to change. But Bush has been unusual in the sense that most American presidents have been willing to knock heads together a little bit, have been willing to push the Israelis in a certain direction, to push the Palestinians to intervene in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And Bush's policy has been just to let the right-wing Israeli leadership do whatever it likes.
Thanks very much, David, for your call. Let's go to Jeff from Pewaukee next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a comment.
Go right ahead.
Well, it looks to me like there's a certain small percentage of the Muslim population, I don't know what, 2%, 5%, that is absolutely dead set against the existence of the State of Israel, and they're going to continue to fight to the death against the existence of the State of Israel. And my solution, although I know Israel probably wouldn't accept it, is from a Christian viewpoint, and that is our teachings from the Christian religion is if somebody wants something from you, you don't fight about it. You give it back, give it to them, and just, you know, give up on it. And I don't think there's any solution to the existence of the State of Israel as long as we have this, you know, jihad going on against the state by this radical, you know, Muslim population. And my solution would be to give every Israeli a visa to come to live in the United States. We have 5 million Jews in here right now. We could easily accommodate another 5 million. And give the land of Israel back to Palestine. That doesn't mean Jews couldn't continue to live there. Muslims have always accepted a Jewish presence in their midst. But otherwise, I think we're headed to World War III over there.
Professor Cole, we have about 30 seconds.
Oh, well,
yeah.
that's a scenario I don't anticipate happening soon. I don't think that the existence of Israel is in question. I think, you know, Israel itself has a big Arab population, about a fifth of the country, and it has peace treaties with Egypt and Jordan. The question is not Israel. The question is the West Bank and Gaza, the continued Israeli colonization of those two areas, and
a resolution of this conflict between Israel and the Palestinian people. And if that were done, I think peace would break out.
Professor Cole, thanks so much. The book is still coming out in March?
It is.
Great. We'll talk to you, if not before, then definitely at that point.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin. Professor Cole. Professor Juan Cole, our guest this half hour, Richard P. Mitchell, Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. His new book, Engaging the Muslim World, and we'll interview him on that when it comes out in March. We also thank Charles Levinson, who was on the Gaza border, Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, for being with us the first half hour of this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our new Milwaukee studios at the Henry Royce Federal Plaza. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We'll talk more about this, of course, in the days ahead. News coming up in a moment from National Public Radio, and we'll continue with our Tuesday morning conversation. It's a minute before 10. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.